The headlines again. Relief agencies have said the humanitarian situation in Gaza is continuing to deteriorate. Lorries loaded with aid have not been given permission to enter at the southern Rafah border with Egypt. King Abdullah of Jordan has warned that the region is teetering on the edge of the abyss. Israel's military has said it has killed four people who were trying to cross into the country from Lebanon to plant explosives. Hamza Yousef has given his first conference speech as leader of the SNP, announcing plans to freeze council tax and cut NHS waiting lists. The Welsh Government has announced budget cuts for this year worth hundreds of millions of pounds. A hearing has been told that the charity set up in the name of Captain Sir Tom Moore is likely to close down. BBC News.
Jane Steele was tonight's newsreader. This is BBC Radio 4. We'll be mixing laughter with medicine in just a moment for tonight's 6:30 comedy. Before that, let's hear from Kirsty Young.
Young again, when I take my guests back to meet their younger selves.
I'm very transparent, maybe sometimes too much.
I don't think so. But...
And ask the question, if you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
Your biggest fears just come to you. Boom, then you have to deal with it. Then you move through it. And then you're around people that get you.
Still to come in the series, Steve Coogan.
My mother said, your dad said to me, said, when you think what a nuisance he was, it was almost like I couldn't believe I'd actually made, not only was it successful, I was actually making a living.
Young Again, with me, Kirsty Young, continues on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds Tuesday mornings at 11.
Now on Radio 4, Best Medicine, Kerry Pritchard-McLean hears about a revolutionary pill on a string and the history of surgery in the Middle Ages.
McLean. This is Best Medicine, the show that celebrates medicine's past, present and future. With me today to make a case for what they think is the best medicine are Professor Rebecca Fitzgerald, OBE, Dr. Jack Hartnell, comedian Tanya Moore and Dr. Tallulah Oni. Tallulah, we're going to start with you, as I think reading out your job description is going to take a while. So... You're a public health physician scientist and urban epidemiologist leading the Global Diet and Physical Activity Research Group at Cambridge, and you're an extraordinary professor and chair at Urban Better at the University of Pretoria. Did you know what you wanted to be when you grew up? You are impressive with a capital I. I bet you're going to tell me next that you just relax by running marathons.
Well, technically, ultramarathons.
What's an ultramarathon then?
So basically anything longer than a marathon, because I used to live in Cape Town, and so I once ran over the mountains a marathon a day for 5 days, and it was incredible, actually. It sounds
awful.
Bad.
Sounds awful, yeah. How far did you run in those 5 days?
250 kilometres in the end, yeah.
That's got to be a Strava PB, that, hasn't it? Imagine not just coming back from a marathon, but coming back from an ultra marathon. Tell me, were you ultra smug about it?
I was. But I perhaps shouldn't have been. Because I was in South Africa, as I mentioned. I had to come back to the UK. And I planned it to fly that night. So feeling super efficient, you know, sleep for 12 hours. And that would recover and I'd be ready to go to work.
The bit of paper says you're clever, but I think we've already spotted a hole in your plan here. So what happened on that 12 hours?
So I woke up, having landed, because I sleep very well on planes, and I couldn't move. I literally couldn't move. It's the best holiday, but, you know, T's and C's apply.
I knew that running was bad for you, and I now feel so vindicated. So, Tanya, you're not a doctor.
No, not yet.
Not yet. I like your ambition.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know, what is your favourite thing about visiting the doctors?
What I like about visiting the doctors is watching the many different ways people try and speak to the receptionist without everyone else hearing their information. It's wonderful. And especially now we've got the Perspex glasses up and they're like trying to speak underneath or round the side. It's like, Jonathan, I can hear you and I'm coming to your house. Stop being weird. Do you know what I mean?
Until you find out what Jonathan's got and then you're not going to his house.
Yeah.
Love it. Now, Jack, you are an associate professor of art history at the University of East Anglia, and you specialise in the artistic materials of medicine, cartography and mathematics in the 13th to the 15th century. What a flex.
I think if you add a series of centuries after anyone's biog, it always sounds impressive. Well, I guess people do think that I can just reel off a bunch of medieval cures, like, you know, hanging weasel's testicles around your neck or something like that, which is actually a genuine suggestion for improving your chances of conceiving.
Was to help you conceive, you would hang weasel's testicles around your neck?
I mean, makes total sense, doesn't it?
You're getting such a vivid visual. Yeah. And finally, Rebecca Fitzgerald, OBE, is a professor of cancer prevention at the University of Cambridge and director of the Early Cancer Institute, which is part of Cancer Research UK Cambridge Centre. Rebecca, have you always wanted to be a doctor?
Yeah, you know, I think I have. I was about five, apparently, when I told my mum that I'm going to be a doctor. And she said that I was really kind of demonstrating it because I had a rather serious babysitter called Miss Stibbs, an older lady, no first name terms. But I bandaged her up every time she came. Serious bandaging. I mean, she looked more like a mummy at the end of it than anything else.
That's so nice to have it from 5 years old, wanting to be a doctor. So lovely, because your parents can be like, oh, we've got a pension. Something my parents will never know the security of. Okay, that is the gang. Let's get started. So, Rebecca, what do you think is the best medicine?
The best medicine, I think, is early diagnosis of cancer, catching it early enough to cure it. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about one way of doing this for cancer of the esophagus or the gullet, and it's called cytosponge, the cytosponge test. So, the problem with cancer of the esophagus, so this tumour can just grow to quite a size until you really realise, and then you may start having difficulty swallowing, losing weight, and by that point you've already got quite an advanced cancer.
Oh, wow.
So the way to really transform the outcomes is to get it much, much earlier. So the risk factors are very common things that you probably wouldn't even worry about. So having a bit of heartburn, which most of us get at some time. So what we want to do is to, rather than waiting for an endoscopy, which is a bit of an unpleasant test.
So is that camera down the throat?
Big camera down the throat. We can't be doing endoscopy on everyone with a bit of heartburn.
Yeah.
It's just completely impractical. So you need a really simple test. So enter cytosponge. So cytosponge is a capsule on a thread.
Well, can I tell you what I'm saying? A pill on a string.
Pill on a string.
Have you invented being a drugs mule?
So it's a pill on a string and you swallow it down. And you wait literally 5 minutes, and the pill dissolves, and out pops the sponge. So let me just give you a demo. I've got a bottle of water here. So if I pop that pill into the water and just wait, the pill will dissolve, and out will pop the sponge. I mean, this is a really, really easy test to do. So you're sitting in your GP surgery. You don't have to go to the hospital. You're going to just swallow this pill with some water.
Do you just sit there with a string hanging out your mouth?
Yeah, 5 minutes later, a nurse is going to pull it out. And the whole idea is to collect cells from the esophagus.
And so anything that's there that's untoward will show up on this sponge?
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
You collect. You won't believe this. 1 to 4 million cells.
Whoa. Exactly. Oh, my gosh, I can see it coming out.
Can you see it coming out?
It looks like...
Oh, my God!
We can see the pill is dissolving and this big sponge is coming out of it. What does it make? It looks like one of those things that you get your dead skin off in the shower with.
Yeah.
What is it?
Pads.
Yeah.
It's a bit like a Brillo pad, isn't it? But it's a bit softer than that. It's spherical. We just put the sponge into a very simple pot, send it to the lab. And what we've made is a special test. It uses an antibody that recognises a protein that's very specific for the precancer cells that stains them brown so that they stand out and identify someone who might be at risk.
How long has cytosponge been around?
It was about 14 years ago or so. I was thinking about, you know, how can we get a simpler way to diagnose these cases early?
So it's your idea?
So it's what we developed in Cambridge, this and the lab test that goes with it.
Have you ever tried it?
Oh, yes. I did the first one. I hadn't really thought it through. I thought, I'll have my lunch, then I'll do it. So the nurse came up to my office. I'd had a nice chicken sandwich.
What a way to find out you're in the early stages of a chicken sandwich.
So you have to have not eaten for a few hours before you have this test there.
Cytosponge. How did you get that name?
Well, cyto means cells.
Oh, yeah, I get
and
it now.
Sponge.
But it's a sponge on a rope that comes back. Why did you call it the cyto sponge and not a spongy jump? Is it something patients can have now?
It's what we call an implementation pilot in the NHS, so it's around 61 hospitals using it for people on their waiting lists. We've done a huge trial, this was before COVID, of 13,000 patients, and showed that offering patients this test could diagnose 10 times more pre-cancer than what GPs ordinarily do.
Wow.
So although we're doing tests within the NHS for people on waiting lists, for this to be a national screening programme, wait for it, we're doing a 120,000 patient randomised trial.
Wow. So, Rebecca, to sum up, why do you think the cyto sponge is the best medicine?
The secret to improving outcomes for cancer, I think, is being more proactive. And I think cyto sponge, I hope, is a step in the right direction for diagnosing this really horrible cancer earlier.
What do you think is the best medicine, and don't say running?
Well, what if I told you that there was a medicine that can reduce your risk of a stroke, it can reduce your risk of dementia, lung cancer and asthma, it can increase your sperm count, much better than weasel balls. What if I told you that medicine exists?
I would say sign me up. What is it?
It's fresh air.
Back to the running.
See what you did there. I won't see you.
Can I just say to the audience, however shocking that statistic is, because it's amazing, please don't inhale in surprise, because you're going to affect those statistics.
Fresh air, because air pollution increases the risk of all of these things. It increases the risks of preterm, so low birth weight babies and premature births, all the way up to strokes and heart attacks and everything in between. But it's so normalized that globally, more than 9 out of 10 people breathe polluted air that doesn't meet the World Health Organization standards. Wow. So I actually started treating individuals, but I got to a point, and I was working in South Africa at the time, I was kind of general medicine, and I started realizing there was this dissonance, right? Firstly, I noticed that people had all of these conditions that were preventable, like hypertension, diabetes, and I started realizing that we were doing this role play where I would say, you need to eat better, you need to walk, you need to get outside. But when I stepped outside of the clinic, I realized that how can you say go for a walk and get some fresh air if actually the risk of getting run over, or if the city is not designed in a way that thinks about you, it's almost negligent to get people to do that. So that's kind of how I moved into urban epidemiology, which is basically just a term I've coined. It's a tip. If you're doing something and there isn't a phrase for it, you just create something, right? So.
No. That CV's adding up now, isn't it?
Yeah, somebody asked me recently, how do you become an urban epidemiologist? I'm like,
Is that why you spelled Cambridge with a silent P on it? Okay.
So I moved from my patients being individuals to my patients being cities.
Oh my gosh. You have to put a giant thermometer at the M25. Surely you don't need to. I mean, if cities are patients, you don't need to save every patient, right? Milton Keynes.
Talking about public health, well, you know, and the health of cities, I think it's widely acknowledged by historians that we've definitely gone backwards rather than forwards. There's a strong knowledge, say, in the European Middle Ages that a healthy city is good. And there were more bin collections every week in the 15th century in Norwich than there are today.
Do you do a lot of pub quizzes?
So the other interesting part of us, not only are my patients cities, but actually who I consider health workers, then necessarily is different, right? Mm. Because we know that over 80% of factors that influence our health lie out of healthcare.
Wow.
But when we talk about who a health worker is, we think about healthcare.
Mm. Yes.
So who specifically would you deem a health worker then that we might not?
So I deem urban planners as health workers because they shape the space, wow. right? So our access to green, because we know also the green infrastructure helps to clean the air. I think of architects as health workers. In fact, I gave a talk once at the Royal Institute for British Architecture, and I said at the start, like, who here is a health worker? And then no one put their hand up. And I did the whole thing, and at the end, I was like, who's a healthcare worker? And everyone put their hands up, like, yeah! Yeah. And I said I would give out badges that said, I'm a health worker, ask me how.
Also, you need another badge that says, if you're having a heart attack, I can't help you.
So I actually got young people in Lagos, in Cape Town, in Accra, to design their own running routes in different parts of their city and to run with an air quality monitor.
Amazing.
And then they looked at their findings. You're doing a diagnosis, right? Mm. And then they designed policy prescriptions. What is the prescription for the city?
That's amazing.
You know, and so this is the power of measurement, and this is the power of engaging people.
So what's the number one prescription for, like, you talked about prescriptions for cities. What's the one big thing that they should all be doing?
I've got a really good example from Wales where they wanted to understand what the impact of upgraded housing was. So it was a kind of natural experiment where, you know, it was happening anyway. They were upgrading the social housing stock. And it was a complex intervention. It was a combination of your heating source, your cooking source, the ventilation, the lighting, access to green space, etc. Mm. And they found that over a 10-year period, the people that had access to the upgraded housing had the risk of emergency admissions reduced by 40% from any cause. 40%.
Wow.
Can you imagine if we had that as a pill?
Yeah, well, fingers crossed it's not a suppository. Deep breath, deep breath. Well, this is going to feel like a bit of a stupid question now, but it's a format point. Why is fresh air the best medicine?
Well, I can add something to everything I've just said, which is that it also is climate action. Because by addressing air pollution, you're taking climate action because many of the pollutants are also greenhouse gases. Mm. Two for one.
Mm. Okay, girl. So good. Tallulah, thank you so much for cracking open the metaphorical window and letting some fresh air into all of our lives. Right. Jack, what do you think is the best medicine?
So my pitch for the best medicine is showmanship. So I work on the later Middle Ages. So let's pick a year, say around the year 1400, transport ourselves back there. In the year 1400, there have been universities for a couple of centuries in Europe. And, you know, these are very studious, scholarly people, really interested in the theory of medicine. But actually, I'm more interested in other kinds of healers. Historians of medicine call them empirics. These are much more kind of hands-on people who are trained kind of on the job. So midwives, apothecaries who might make medicines for you, and in particular, I'm really interested in surgeons. So if you think about the etymology of the word surgery, tracking back to the Greek kir, hand, urgos, work. So it's literally handiwork. It's what you're doing with your hands. You know, the kind of person who would train as a medic at university is very different. No one on this panel would have done, because firstly, it's only open
I feel to... like Tallulah would have had a go. She gets stuck in, whack something else on the CV.
Universities in that moment are only open to men, and they're only open to good kind of Christian men. So as a Jewish guy, I'm out of there. So I think that's why I think empirics in other ways are quite interesting, because they maybe represent some slightly more diverse kinds of people, but also different ways of learning and thinking. So in terms of showmanship, what I think is really interesting is that the way they comport themselves, the things they own, the objects they have, become super important for whether people trust them or not. I've brought an image along, which I wonder maybe actually, Kiri, could you describe it for us?
It's sort of models from the waist down. All of them have got willies. Some of them have got their legs open, and it looks like quite exciting things up their bum. One of them has got sort of an arm with it looks like a massive rod heading towards the bum. One's got looks like a finger up their bum. This is, it looks like one hell of an 18th party.
It's a really, really interesting image in the history of medicine. So this is from a manuscript. It's in the British Library. It's one of the amazing things, by the way, about working with material objects. You know, these are part of national collections. Anyone can go to the British Library and just...
Don't tell those perverts that.
Under the close scrutiny of the librarian.
That's how they like it.
I'm just thinking of the white gloves. This is a page from a manuscript probably made in the early 1400s in England, and it contains a text that was originated by an English surgeon. His name's John Ardern. And one thing he did particularly well was heal anal fistulas. So effectively, a fistula is a kind of abnormal kind of tube that forms between two organs or between the organ and the skin. So if you imagine if you have an abscess because, say, you're riding in a saddle for a long time on a horse, you might get irritated and it becomes infected and...
You're making cowboys a lot less sexy here. Deleted scene from Brokeback Mountain.
Well, John Ardern came up with a new way of treating this disease and, I'm told by doctors, is very, very similar to the kind of procedure we use today, just with slightly more sophisticated instruments. And also, this is what I'm interested in as an art historian, this is the first ever image that we know of in Europe that shows multiple stages of an operation in action. So these aren't four different floating crazy figures. It's the same person with
same
different...
Same bum. Same,
it's the same bum.
Same bum.
Yeah. It's lovely. Not just the same bum. I mean, look at those stockings that these figures are wearing.
Oh, yeah.
These long, pointy shoes. So this is where we come to the showmanship. Because those long shoes are incredibly fashionable in the 14th and 15th century in England.
Can I be honest? That is, when I look at that picture, the stockings and the shoes are not the first thing that I'm drawn to. Because also, if he's keeping his winkle pickers on during anal fistula surgery, he's keeping his socks on during sex, isn't he?
These are long, fancy shoes. What does that tell you? That tells us that who the patient is important. And suddenly we start to think about this not just as a book that contains information, but it's doing all sorts of complicated social
cues. For
exactly.
Her.
I might turn to my well-stocked library and go, I'm going to open up this book, which has got all these beautiful images and all this text. And suddenly it's kind of like maybe the equivalent of a modern-day white coat. Or, you know, how doctors hang a diploma?
Yes.
You know, and you kind of find yourself scrutinising whether they went as a good medical school or not, as if you know anything about that. There are lots of different kinds of things that fit into this category of kind of performative objects. This, for instance, is a...
Is this a saw?
It's a surgical saw that was probably used at some point in the 15th or 16th century.
It looks like a hacksaw where you can replace the blade, but it's very ornate. And it looks like it's got sort of carvings on the handle.
Yeah, it's got this kind of wonderful elephant trunk that's firing out this giant tongue. Now, what's interesting is we look at that and think, God, that is so unsanitary. And actually, surgeons at the time, they write about how it's uncomfortable to hold because the handle's in the shape of a dragon. You know, they say, actually, these don't work that well. But again, we stop and think, well, if it wasn't that practical, why is it being used? Tools indicate knowledge. But also, they're pricey tools. How did he get paid? His patient survived to pay him at the end of it. There's lots written in the Middle Ages, books that are written by surgeons for other surgeons, as to how they should comport themselves with patients, you know. Don't be too invasive, but be polite. Don't take on a patient who's too sick to cure, because you'll get blamed for their death.
What? That's
well, I mean, if you're thinking about the practice...
It's a business.
I wouldn't expect, obviously, in the scrupulous world of the NHS, but, I mean, these kind of health outcomes...
Are you looking at me?
So these are kind of all these, again, these objects tell these really interesting stories. Okay, this is a small manuscript. I should say it easily fits into the palm of your hand. This is an amazing example in the Wellcome Collection in London. It's got this beautiful embroidered outside.
So this is sort of a fold-out manuscript?
That's exactly what it is, yeah. So these are, some people call them girdle books or bat books because they kind of flap open like big wings of an animal.
Oh.
But why would you have a book in such an inconvenient format that you have to flick, 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 it's attached to your belt, flick, 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 pull open, open again, open aside, open again?
Yeah.
It's because the performance of opening it is part of the showmanship of the medicine.
Oh.
So you're saying,
it's the theatre of it.
I mean, you could memorise the contents of that book in an hour.
Could, mate. I've seen your qualifications, you could.
Well, there's not that much in there, but these beautiful, these very expensive things as well. So again, it's about the performance.
If my doctor got out a pop-out book, to be like, I'm going to explain your anal fissure, I'm like, I'm all right, thanks. So, Jack, why do you think that showmanship is the best medicine?
I think showmanship's the best medicine because you have to have a degree of confidence in the people who are giving you the best medicine.
Turns out that all you needed to become a doctor then is have a sore as well. And all you need to become a comedian is a history of bedwetting. Thanks so much to Jack. Finally, Tanya, what... Come on, have a go. Tanya, what do you think is the best medicine?
I think alkaline breathing is the best medicine. And I say that your face is like, what the hell is alkaline breathing? It's a kind of therapy. It's like breath work, basically. And what it does is it allows you to kind of explore the deeper space of you. Because what happens is, as human beings, what we do is if you hurt yourself physically, you will rush to go and get that seen to. If you cut yourself, you'll get a plaster. What we don't do is look after our emotional healings, do you know what I mean? And what that does is it gets right to the part of your body where the pain is coming from, which you don't always realise.
I've never heard of alkaline breathing.
Oh, I love it.
It sounds like something that Heston Blumenthal would make. That he'd sort of pair with thought of duck and shrug on a spinach. Is it just deep breaths?
No, well, yeah, kind of and not. It's about what you're doing. For example, if I'm like in a space where I'm anxious, I do like a 4-7-8. So you breathe in for 4, you hold for 7, you breathe out for 8. What it allows you to do is just center yourself. Like an internal hug for the body.
I love that you're giving panic attacks a positive rebrand. No. What are you seeing and feeling while you're doing this?
Oh, man, do you know, I go and see a breathwork therapist and I think she's just wonderful. So, before you even get into her house, you can smell her house because she sets the space with all these different scents and smells, right? Then you have the 5-4-3-2-1 where you close your eyes and you listen to 5 things and you smell 4 things and you feel 3 things. Then you go bang into that one-on-one, baby. And it's really intense, honestly. And then you go to like a heightened state and then whatever happens there, that's your business. Then you come back, right? And baby, that's the end of the session. You just go home and you're like, oh my God, who am I? I don't even know. It's wonderful.
Or is it like a trance?
That's a good question. I would go with heightened state. I had an appointment and we did one-on-one alkaline breathing. And I remember just going into this dark space. I was in this dark space. And what I can remember is like, like a light when it swings. When it was swinging, I would see this window. On the other side of the window was like me, but like 8 years old. Right? Yeah, so it kept swinging. As it kept swinging, I kept being like, oh my God, where's she gone? She's so fit. Anyway, so then what happened was it swung for one last time and I didn't see me again. But then behind me was me taking off this rucksack off my back and running away, swear to God. And then I had to wake up. I was pulled out of my session. And since then, there's been things about my body that have been easier for me to process and get through.
Wow.
I know, it's a trip. It's like free drugs.
It doesn't sound like that person will be free.
Good point, actually.
I should point out, I have to say this, don't try this at home, kids.
Yes.
Tanya does this in a session with an expert.
Yes.
Always talk to your doctor first about whatever condition you're looking for help with. You don't want to find out you've got an underlying condition that might make this unsafe.
I take this more as a therapy. If you break your arm, don't go and see a breathwork therapist.
So why do you think that alkaline breathing is the best medicine then?
Something serious happened to me last year. And to move past it, I had to go to my breathwork therapist to figure out where that pain was residing in my body. So
wow.
I can now talk about that thing that happened to me because when I do talk about it, even now thinking about it, the pain is rising, but it's not making me feel like, I know what it is and I'm okay with it and it's
wow.
Okay. Yeah, I can just breathe through it.
Oh, fantastic. Give it up for Tanya. Choose the best medicine: showmanship, fresh air, breathing therapy, and a pill on a string. At Glastonbury, I don't have to choose. Okay, right. It's between fresh air, because also, yeah, I mean, if we didn't have fresh air, we wouldn't be able to do the breathing therapy, so we need that.
That's true.
The size of sponge is absolutely amazing as well. So I've narrowed it down to Tallulah and Rebecca. Okay, it's so bad because I do get heartburn, I'm absolutely going to sign up, but I think I'm going to give it to fresh air.
Yes!
Thank you for my amazing guests. I've now got to go and take part in a medical trial. So join me next time when I'm going to have 4 brand new guests and 4 new ears stitched to my back. Goodbye! Medicine was hosted by me, Kiri Pritchard-McLean, and featured Professor Rebecca Fitzgerald, Dr. Jack Hartnell, Tanya Moore, and Dr. Tallulah Oney. It was written by Laura Claxton, Edward Easton, Pravanya Pillay, Kiri Pritchard-McLean, Nikki Roberts, and Ben Rouse. The assistant producer was Tashi Rada, the producer was Ben Warsfield, and it was a Large Time production for BBC Radio 4.
And next week's programme is a special on breasts with revolutionary injectable radioactivity and an AI algorithm that detects breast cancer in seconds. And there's more comedy tonight over on our digital sister station, BBC Radio 4 Extra, with programmes including sketch comedy The Pin and the fantasy sitcom Elven Quest, which stars Stephen Mangan. Jake Yap is your host tonight for The Comedy Club. It starts at 10 on Radio 4 Extra.
On BBC Sounds.
Newscast is the unscripted chat behind the headlines.
It's informed, but informal.
We pick the day's top stories.
And we find experts who can really dig into them.
We use our colleagues in the newsroom and our contacts.
Some people pick up the phone rather faster than others.
We sometimes literally run round the BBC building grabbing the very big guests.
Join us for daily news chats.
To get you ready for today's conversations.
Newscast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. Palestinian health officials in Gaza say at least 200 people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike that hit a hospital in the centre of the territory. Officials say there may be hundreds of victims in the rubble. The Israeli army has not yet commented. Its bombardment of Gaza has been continuing in retaliation for the deadly attack by Hamas more than a week ago. Relief agencies say the humanitarian situation across Gaza is getting worse by the minute, with supplies of food and fuel now perilously low. Lorries loaded with aid are queuing up at the southern Rafah crossing from Egypt, but have not been given permission to enter the territory. Matthias Kennes from Médecins Sans Frontières says his staff no longer have access to safe drinking water.
My staff reporting that they do not have access to potable water. One of my staff mentioned that he's sharing the house with 120 people.